Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this evening. On our way to our conversation, I remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it is a credit union, not just a bank, so it belongs to you. Dividends come back every year. www.mecu.com is their website. You can go to steinershow.org and click their banner on there as well. MeQ, M-E-C-U.com. We are joined this hour by Dr. P.M. Forney. Massimo Forney has been on the show numerous times over the years, first in 1998 when he first started the Civility Project at Johns Hopkins University, which we'll talk a bit about so we can get some groundwork. His most recent book, which we'll be talking about tonight, is The Thinking Life, How to Thrive in the Age of Distraction. And his previous books include Choosing Civility and The Civility Solution. He's also a professor of Italian literature at Johns Hopkins University. And Massimo Forney, welcome. Good to have you back with
us. I'm so delighted to be here, Mark.
It's always good to see you.
Good to see you again.
So take us back just for a moment for our listeners who may not be familiar with your project, the Civility Project that you started back, in 1997, and what that was and what you were doing.
I had been a straight literary scholar for about 15 or 20 years of my career then in the mid-1990s. I was a professor of medieval Italian literature, and I was teaching at a major university, a research university, and that was my role in life. I would write books on Dante or Boccaccio that all of 12 people read around the world, tomes of academic nature, but that was fine. However, this changed in the mid-1990s. I realized that I needed new challenges. I really wanted to continue to practice my trade of professor of Italian literature, but I needed to dedicate myself to something that had a little bit more direct relevance with everyday life. And one day, I was teaching my Dante course to my undergraduates, and I had them in front of me in the class. And I looked at them, and a thought occurred to me that had not occurred to me before. And the thought was, I want my students to know everything that there is to know about Dante. But even if they did, and then they went out to be unkind to a little old lady on a bus, I would think that I had failed as a teacher. It was an odd thought, but it stayed with me, and it really changed my life. And I fell in love. I thought of, now I look back at those years as my sort of middle age crisis, the middle age crisis of a professor of the Middle Ages. But out of that crisis came this great love and interest and the will of doing advocacy around this wonderful notion that we call civility.
And if I remember right, we talked about it just before we went on the air. You were working in prisons as well.
The first activities that we did was going to Jessup, the maximum security prison near Baltimore. And we taught a course on civility, good manners, and politeness to the inmates there. And at the end of the semester, we brought our students at Hopkins who had read the same books that the inmates had read, and we provided this for this occasion of encounter between these two groups. And it was wonderful to see what came out of that and to see our students realizing that there was a world that they had never imagined. And myself, having taught Dante's Inferno for many years, I hadn't realized that where it resided, and I realized that it resided at Jessup. But our students said, Dr. Forney, we have learned more in one night at Jessup than in 4 years at Johns Hopkins, which I said to myself, well, I'm glad. But then I thought that there was a double-edged to that compliment, of course.
And about even the thought of men serving time, real serious time in prison, studying Dante's Inferno,
Yes, absolutely. But what they yearned was the contact. Our students learned things that really could not have learned in any other way. There was a young inmate. He looked as if he were perhaps 22. And clean-shaven, nice-looking young man. And I asked him, for how long he had been at Jessup. And he said, "Oh, Dr. Forney, I'm just new here. It's only 5 years." Now, here was a young man who was probably 22, and 5 years was one-third or one-fourth of his life. And probably he had ahead of himself, he was looking to 40 years without parole. And so 5 years was nothing. And these are experiences that are heartbreaking, but are very instructive for young men and women who brought from there from the Homewood campus.
Now, your new book here, The Thinking Life, How to Thrive in an Age of Distraction. Let me just start this way. One of the things that I thought in looking at reading this book was that it seemed as if, and I maybe don't jump too far ahead into the book, but it struck me as I read this particular part of your book, the part of your book on thoughtfulness.
Yes.
Right? I was thinking about how that thinking about thoughtfulness in the way you do, the way you write about it, is really a consequence of your work about civility. I mean, there's a connection there between
absolutely.
Direct...
You have put the finger on something that I tell every time that I speak in public, that's probably my important chapter, because it's a linchpin between what I did before and I'm still doing, but where I started with civility and good manners and the connection between civility and the quality of life, and this new interest on thinking. So I have been fascinated as a non-speaker of the English, not non-native speaker of language, by the notion of thoughtfulness, because thoughtful is a double word. You're thoughtful when you think a lot, and you're thoughtful when you think a lot about others, and
right.
you're considerate and kind. And so it's one of my favorite words, really. And now the reader of my new book immediately understands that there is an ethical component to thinking and an ethical component to being civil. And it is that ethical dimension that I always wanted to be an advocate of, and that I try to stress every time I speak in public. I would not have spent the past 15, 16 years of my life talking about civility and civil behavior unless I had perceived that the reason that civility, good manners, and politeness are not trivial is very simple. They do the everyday, easy, busy work of goodness. And so civility and thinking about others is about being the best that you can and acknowledging the value of other people and begin to really understand that what really is important in life is connections. Life is a relational experience. And it is when we are good at relating and connecting that we are good people, and that happiness becomes a possibility.
There's a connection, and then we'll go back to take a little path from the front of the book on. But what the connection is that both definitions of thoughtfulness, whether it's the deep thinking
yes.
about whatever it is,
yes.
whether it's what
reflection,
whether it's the meal you're about to prepare, or on a tree you're looking at, or on your children, or just on something you've read, whatever that is.
Yes.
And being thoughtful
yes.
towards other human beings, they're connected. It's almost impossible to think about doing one without the other.
In fact, that is so true, because civility is a form of attention. It's a form of awareness. We are civil when we are aware of others, and we weave restraint, respect, and consideration into that very fabric of attention. And we cannot have love without attention. We cannot love someone without tending to his or her needs and desires. And the same is true for civility. We cannot be civil without thinking about the well-being of others and being willing to do something to help that.
410-319-8888, when you feel like it, join us in the conversation with Dr. P.M. Forney. He wrote the books Choosing Civility and The Civility Solution. His latest book is The Thinking Life, How to Thrive in the Age of Distraction. You've seen those bumper stickers all over the place on people, back of people's cars, choose civility. Now, you had something to do with those bumper stickers, didn't you? Or did it come organically out of the work you did?
No,
someone else did it.
No, there was a specific circumstance when that happened. About 6 or 7 years ago, when they started, this is the library in our county. They asked me to speak, to give a keynote at their yearly meeting of all of the personnel of the library. And I went there and I spoke about civility. And they picked up the ball and they started running, and they haven't stopped running with the ball.
So that's where the bumper stickers came from.
Yes, that's how the bumper stickers came into being. And you know that there have been also spin-offs of comedic nature. There are bumper stickers that say, "Choose senility in our county," for instance, and so on. So I guess when you get spoofed by that, that's the top honor for someone who has tried to launch something.
As we talk to PM 40, 410-319-8888, many of you have said to yourself, "I'm overscheduled, I don't have time to think, that life is just too busy, there's too much to do." I mean, this is the world we're in, and we all kind of are in that, most of us are in that mode of worrying about that.
Yes, I think that like in every other subject that has to do with life, we have to, in order to understand the importance of it, we have to understand what is in it for us. Thinking, first of all, is what makes us human, and we shouldn't forget that. And also, it expands our range of options, and it helps us to choose wisely among these options. Very often we do what we do because it doesn't occur to us to do it in a different way. The range of our thinking is not wide enough. But when we are training thinking and in critical thinking, we have more options, and thinking allows us to choose wisely among these options. Thinking allows us to make good decisions. There is a connection between good thinking and good decisions. Thinking allows us to arrive at the crossroads of life when we have to make an important decision, prepared. There is only one way of getting in trouble in life, and that's arriving unprepared to the crossroads of lives when we have to make important decisions. Thinking prepares us for that. Thinking prepares us for life. So when we talk about the importance of the rediscovering thinking, we are talking about a very crucial thing to do.
When you have a line in your book early on that unfortunately deep thinking is often the illustrious casualty in the digital revolution. When you make statements like that, or like no cyber loitering does not qualify as thinking, and no, we cannot truly thrive without engaging in real thinking. I mean, the danger is here that we lose the ability to think because we're always so engaged elsewhere.
Yes, there is still a lot of study to be done, a lot of research, and a lot of people are starting to research this field. But there seems to be a very strong possibility that when we spend so many hours per day on that kind of field that we call the Internet, and we acquaint ourselves and we spend the time on very short messages, and we lose the ability to deep thinking, to deep reading and to deep thinking. I don't know how many people today are willing or able to read War and Peace from the beginning to the end, or David Copperfield. I know that there are colleagues of mine, not at Hopkins but elsewhere, but intellectuals who say, "I cannot do that anymore. I cannot read David Copperfield. I cannot read Ulysses or Dostoevsky's novels, because I cannot sustain the attention for such a long time. I will read a page and then I'll stop, and I have to go back and start the page again because I don't remember what I read." So again, I don't want to sound like a Luddite, and I'm certainly not against the use of these gadgets of mass distraction.
Like the one sitting in front of me?
Right. Yes, and like the ones that I use. I use myself, but I try to use them with some kind of judgment. we are children of our time,
yes.
And we cannot afford to do otherwise.
But it's also we don't. It's the time it takes for many people. Whether it's the digital revolution that kind of always sucks us in to looking at things that are specious and make no sense, which we can talk about in a bit. Or the other part is, you know, I was thinking about in this country where 48% of the people in this country live within 150% of the poverty line, right?
Yes.
Almost half the population of America. And many of those people who live in poverty or close to it work two and three jobs and have children and are trying to survive. When you have a society like that, there is no time to think. Whether it's the digital revolution that occupies students and kids in college, everybody else, the adults who are just driven by this machine, or people who have to work so hard all the time, there's no time to think.
And that's why I think if you are instead in the position of thinking, there is almost a moral imperative for you to do that. And this is what I tell my students at the university. I tell them, you don't know it, you don't think about it, but this is the last opportunity that you will have in your life to thinking full time. To think full time. And if you waste this opportunity, you're really a fool. And unfortunately, what the studies about habits of our students in college tell us is that they study about 15 hours per week, which is not enough.
Right.
And in the 1960s, the college students studied about 25 hours per week. So there is a decrease in study time of 42%. And there is no reason for that. It shouldn't be like that. They should be thinking that they are privileged to take advantage of this wonderful situation in which they could be thinking full time. But this is also true in the world of work. We know, for instance, that bosses use only 3 to 4% of their time to plan the future long planning, long-term planning. And then they are frustrated. If you ask people who work in organizations and corporations and have higher level jobs, they say that one of the things that is really frustrating for them is that they cannot find the time to think. They cannot find the time to do long-term planning. And it's always putting out the next fire, and it's always planning for tomorrow. So there is the crisis of thinking on campus, but there is the crisis of thinking also in the world of work.
And speaking of work, one of the things you write about is that we don't think we don't think of thinking as work or as hard work.
That's right.
Right.
Americans also think of themselves as doers, not as thinkers.
That's the line you use, exactly.
And,
right.
And there is this sort of anti-intellectualist. Anti-intellectualism that has always been part of the one strand of the culture of America that is still there. And many parents don't want their children to be eggheads. And the children very often who would be inclined to study, intelligent and eager to learn, very often hide their intellectual side because they want to conform with their peers. And if their peers perceive them as thinkers, they will be the object of ridicule and they will be bullied.
410-319-8888. Dr. P.M. Forney is with us. His latest book is The Thinking Life, How to Thrive in the Age of Distraction. That would be a contradiction. And his other books recently were Choosing Civility and The Civility Solution. 410-319-8888. I'm just curious, when people, when you hear the idea of I'm too busy to think, there's just no time for it. Is thinking important to you? Is thinking important in our lives, your children's lives? 410-319-8888. What difference does it make? What difference does it make if we have time to think?
Yes, and if you think of it, when you say or when someone says, I don't have the time to think, it's like to say, I don't have the time to be human, because thinking is what makes us human. So in reality, we always have time to think. What we don't have is the willpower to find the time to think, the time to spend with an activities that would be good for us, like thinking. So, with the exception of the situations that you mentioned before of extreme poverty, in that case, really, people are so exhausted at the end of the day who do not have really the time to think clearly. They cannot see clearly given the exhaustion that they experience. But short of those extreme situations, we should be able to and willing to find the time to think, to do what I call to make appointments, to make dates with our brain for the weekend maybe or for one day or 2 days a week. Just create a space, a bubble of tranquility and leisure in which you sit down without turning to the closest screen, and you just follow the movements of the neurons in your brain and see where it takes you. I think that would be very good for our health, because thinking is good for your health, and very good for our future. We fail to spend. We spend more time organizing and planning our summer vacation than preparing for our lives, than planning for our lives.
True.
So. And one reason is that we want to flee from thinking because we are afraid of what we are going to find out if we think about too closely about ourselves and if we engage in introspection.
We're talking about thinking. that if you spend time with yourself. Thinking. I mean, there's meditation that you wrote about a little bit in the book. It's like Buddhist meditation, another kind of form of spiritual meditation, which
yes.
is like the absence of thinking, trying to
clear
your mind. To clear your mind.
Yes.
Which can be important as well.
Absolutely.
But then juxtapose that with the importance of thinking. How do you think? I mean, how do you begin to think? Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, how do you stop everything else that's going on around you and just begin to think?
Well, meditating to cleanse yourself of everything else, it's a good way to start. And also, a very good habit is to set aside some time that never changes week after week. You know that Friday at 5, you have an appointment with your brain that is going to be of 40 minutes. And you're going to sit there and you create this tranquility around you, as I was mentioning a couple of moments ago. And you make a habit of it. You make all efforts that you can in order to observe this appointment that you have with your brain, and also find other ways of, for instance, transforming waiting time in thinking time. I fly a lot when I to give talks around the country. And I must say that my wife will think that I'm being perverse in this. But sometimes when I hear that there is a delay in the plane, I think, oh, I have 45 minutes to think here at the airport. That's great. I'm sure that she objects to this thinking. But there are so many opportunities to think, thinking when you are having lunch, for instance. Going out at midday and take the 45 minutes that you have at your disposal for lunch to sit on a bench, and instead of frenetically go to your handheld device, just think, and maybe if you want take with you also a block note, a notebook, and jot down a few thoughts. Maybe you can use them. For some reason later. So there are ways you can delegate, for instance, part of what you do and make some time for thinking by delegating. So one of the things that I describe in my book, that I list in my books, is all the ways that you can find time and you can set aside time for thinking.
So what, do you think we are in danger of building a world where thinking has become secondary, tertiary, less important because of our time spent working constantly, our time spent on our electronic devices, on all the things that surround us, that distract us, just this immediacy of the everything is about the moment.
I think that I know, actually, and you know, that our lives today are so different from the lives of parents and grandparents that they would not have ever imagined the way that we live today. So we have already changed. We are not like our fathers and our mothers. We don't think about the way that they thought. We don't educate our children the way they did. And so what remains to be seen is going to be how big this change is going to be. And it's early to assess that, but there are many people, and even at Hopkins, we are starting to study the consequences of our new habits of electronic, started in the time when the electronic world became ceased to be a tool and became a way of life. This is what happened in the past 20 years. Technology went from being a tool to being a way of life. And this kind of phenomenon, this kind of change of paradigm there is no doubt that is going to change their lives and the lives of our children who have not known a world without computers.
I want to come back to that because one of the things you write about is the importance of critical thinking and teaching critical thinking, teaching people how to think, teaching young people how to think, which we don't do. And since we're also so tied to this world of electronics, which is not going away, it's the world we're in. The world of Facebook and Twitter are here to stay, or something will take its place that's equally as intense once they flitter off and don't become the technology of the moment. So we'll explore that when we return. We'll take a very brief break. My guest is Dr. P.M. Forney. His latest book, The Thinking Life, How to Thrive in an Age of Distraction, 410-319-8888. Join us. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. I want to remind you that WEAA presents Zimbabwe Shona Stone Exhibit here at WEA, curated by Beverly Carter and Lewis Hudnell, presented by the Zimbabwe Gallery. We want you to join us for the closing reception and gallery talk Tuesday, February 28th from 6:30 to 9 p.m. right here at WEAA Studios. It's an exhibit you don't want to miss, amazing modern sculpture from Zimbabwe. Sponsored by AXA Advisors, information at weaa.org. And then you can peer in the window and watch us do our show live as you're looking at the exhibit, and then we'll be outside to meet you as well. Number here is 410-319-8888. We have the pleasure, once again, of having Dr. P.M. Forney in the house. He is a professor of Italian literature at Johns Hopkins University. What he's become known for is the man who thinks about civility and brought the conversation about civility back into our lives. His previous books that he's been on the show for before, Choosing Civility and the Civility Solution. He first graced these studios in 1998 on our show with his civility project that he created. His most recent book we're talking about today is The Thinking Life, How to Thrive in an Age of Distraction, 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow at gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook page, and we'll see what you have to say there. Speaking of distraction, Facebook pages. But we ended the last part of the half hour was with this idea that these machines, like the one in front of me, this laptop, is not going anywhere. I have Facebook open at the moment. Facebook is here, and it's kind of consumed a lot of people's lives more and more.
Yes.
Twittering all the time.
Social sites.
Oh, they're all
general,
here, right?
Yes.
So that part of existence is not going to go away. It's part of the new age, whatever that is, dawning. It's here. So how do you then, given that that exists and that's not going to go away, A, manage it, but B, starting with the idea that you write about, which is we have to teach critical thinking in our schools to our children and what you think that balance will make?
Well, what I think is that we should see what the offerings of the internet are for what they are. And I think that there are wonderful things on the net, and we can do a lot, and the internet has changed our lives for the better in many ways. But at the same time, there is sort of a dark side to the net. The net is a wonderful thing, but it has also become the dismal collector of the moral toxins of our lives. And there is that aspect. And then there is the aspect of the triviality of it. We are not going to live forever. Our lives are very limited. And if we spend a lot of time on trivial things, there will not be internet elves that return us those lines, those hours that we have spent. They are gone forever. And so we have to be selective of how to use our time. And I'm afraid that the new generations are not being very selective right now. We have to find the strength, the willpower to turn off the computer, to decide to go on those weekends without exposure to the internet that many people do around the world now. These sort of blackouts of the instruments that keep us so shackled to them. And so I think that we have to take life more seriously. We have to give it more importance. And if we take life more seriously and if we deem it more important, then maybe we're going to be more respectful of it and of the time that the way that we invest our time. And the audience that we have to address in particular with this message is the audience of the children, of the youngsters. When you're young, you think that your life will go on forever and you have all the time in your life. Well, that's not the case. We know that, you and I, Mark, that is not exactly the way
it is.
That's
not the case.
But the youngsters need to be told, and need to be told by their parents, need to be told by their teachers. And if the message doesn't get through the first time, we have to keep conveying the message and tell them what is in it for them to leave the computer, leave the screen for an hour or two. We have children who do not know their neighbor and who are not developing a connection with their community because they are inside the house and they are communicating with someone in Bangladesh, but they are not communicating with the person and the youngsters and their peers living next door. And this is absurd. We have to develop a connection with our places, with our towns, with our neighbors. We need to be able to, as children, take our bicycles around and discover the shortcuts, discover where what the neighborhood is like and where who the people are. And shatter the anonymity that is typical of our days. All this is a tall order, but we have to start somewhere, and it's going to be very rewarding for all of us if we manage to do it.
You talked about people walking across campus and things in their ears. Even the time when people walk between places is always
absolutely.
Is always, but you know, and I was thinking about was that even in the 1960s when transistor radios first came out.
Yes.
You had that one little earplug you put in your ear from the transistor radio.
I remember that well.
But that was the beginning of some senses. On one side of looking at it as a distraction, people could have their favorite radio station in their ear whenever they wanted it to hear their music. But on the other hand, it was because people wanted music in their lives.
Yes.
They wanted to hear it. Right?
Yes.
So, I mean, it's this battle between distraction and attention, and which one do you need? Sometimes you need distraction.
Yes, absolutely. It's all a matter of good common sense, of measure, So I have never advocated forgetting the use of these tools, but I do advocate that we be serious about the importance of life and be serious about how to invest our time.
So one of the things you have got people you quoted in this book that really was interesting, the question of whether or not, oh no, here it was, Robert Allen Kaplan, you quote him in your book, who wrote this book, Labyrinth, and I'll let you answer this question. Can people be taught to become outstanding thinkers? Can we teach thinking?
Oh yes, I think that this we can say with certainty. We can teach thinking. We can teach thinking, habits of thinking, and thinking itself. We know that there are, as a matter of fact, schools that have critical thinking on their curriculum. They are not as many as they should be, in my opinion. I think we should teach both civility and thinking in the schools. And after the civility movement of the past 15 years, there are many more schools that teach good manners and civility to their children, and parents are starting to understand that is very important. After these 15 years of promotion of civility, many parents understand that social intelligence is a better predictor of success in life and in school than the intelligence that we measure with IQ. And therefore, they are more willing to teach or having the schools teach manners and civility to their children. It's not that the intelligence that we measure with IQ is not important. You are smart, there is a position, you get the position. But 10 years down the line, the person who will have made more strides in the company or the organization is not necessarily the person who entered with the highest IQ, but is more likely to be the person who entered with the highest ability to entertain harmonious relationships with others, to be a good communicator, to be a good team player. So the parents should understand this and should insist on the schools teach both good manners and good thinking to the children.
410-319-8888. I'm curious how you think of thinking in your life, in your children's life, the idea of teaching critical thinking, the idea of critical choices that we make in the life and how that fits on what we do when it comes to thinking. There's a quote in the back of the book that I will share and see what you all think about that of 410-319-8888, as well as Dr. P.M. Forney kind of comment on this, because I really liked it, Henry James, and we had another author on here the other week who was in love with Henry James. To live in the world of creation, to get into it and stay in it, to frequent it and haunt it, to think intensely and fruitfully, to woo combinations and inspirations into being by a depth and continuity of attention and meditation, this is the only thing.
Yes, and that is a very good comment on taking life seriously. The person who wrote that quotation is a person who takes life seriously, as the serious thing that it is. And listen, I'm going to tell you very briefly why we should bother at all with this line of thinking, with this topic. Good thinking generates good decisions. Good decisions generate a good life, and a good life generates happiness. So there is a direct connection between good thinking and happiness. Second, we often do what we do, and I mentioned this a little bit earlier in the conversation. We often do what we do because we can't think of anything else to do. It is decision-making by default. Thinking does two important things for us. It expands our range of options, and it helps us choose wisely. And finally, thinking is important because it works like a rehearsal of our future. Thinking is rehearsing of our lives before we get to live them. Not thinking is like appearing on a stage without having learned our blocking and our lines. When you get up in the morning and you think about the day, you are rehearsing what is going to happen. So if you find yourself in this, you have a difficult a meeting with a difficult person, you are thinking in advance about that and say, okay, if this person is going to be difficult at the meeting, this is what I can do. So it's a dress rehearsal for life, and that's a very important role that thinking can play. So if we think about these simple reasons, but very important reasons that have to do with the quality of life and the production of happiness in our lives, then we see the relevance and the lack of what we are discussing, and we see that they are far from being trivial interests.
Let me know the phone. You made me think of something about a young man who's been on the show many times. He's a young therapist, Dante Wilson, work he does with kids in his communities in the west side of town. When it comes to thinking, I'll come back to that. But let me go to the phones first.
Okay.
At 410-319-8888. We are getting to the phones here. And Kalik, you're on the air.
Yes. Good evening, gentlemen.
Welcome.
Good evening.
I thoroughly agree. I'm a teacher, by the way. And I see people always use the phrase dumbing down. And I very much appreciate what you're saying, because it opposes that that kind of dynamic of dumbing down our society, or beginning with our children. So it opens the dumbing down dynamic opens the doorway for a lot of degenerate and retro dynamics to take society back instead of moving it forward, instead of improving and attaining a high quality of life and being conscious of that. And that's why I appreciate what you're saying, because I don't see us as being very conscious of the quality of life. If we were, crime would be virtually non-existent. And that's proven by certain societies where crime is non-existent. And they're more of on a spiritual level.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying religious, I'm saying spiritual level. And they just practice the principles that uphold their quality of.
Kalik, I think you make a very strong point. Massimo?
Yes, indeed. I think it was a very strong point. But we have to remember how we arrived at this point. We in America, said Norman Cousins, have everything except the most important thing of all, time to think and the habit of thinking. And this was before the explosion of the computer. Maybe it was hyperbolic on the part of Norman Cousins, but it is indeed true that Americans don't think of themselves as thinkers, but rather as doers, which would be fine if it did not point to a long-standing and still powerfully influential heritage of anti-intellectualism. And this begins to explain why Johnny can think.
Before I come back, let me go back to our next caller, 410-319-8888. Kalik, thank you so much for those thoughts. Glad you're in the school system teaching. Jerry, you're on the air.
Thank you, Mark.
Welcome.
At the present time right now, I am teaching meditation over at Frederick Douglass High School. And prior to this, I also taught meditation over at Lake Clifton. And for myself, it's been a very important practice. I've been practicing meditation for 23 years. And to work with these young high school students in Baltimore City has been a real eye-opener for me, because what it's done is it's given people a place to quiet down all those distractions that we're all faced with, and to allow themselves to go to a deeper place, even a deeper place than the mind, and to settle into that place, which is a safe place. And in this safe place, you can begin to come out of it and think in a new way, with a new confidence of who you are. And I'd like to get some feedback from your guests about that. And thank you, Mark, for having this wonderful show.
Thank you, Jerry, for the call, the question, the
thought. Not only does meditation do what you say about getting you in a safe place, but it's also very good for our physical health. We know that meditation, it goes beyond the mind. It is a thing of the mind that benefits the body. It elicits the production of those wonderful neurochemicals, the neurotransmitters and hormones, the endorphins, for instance, the hormones that are good for you. And so it is a very good practice, both from the point of view of the mental sphere of our lives and of the physical one.
Now, Massimo, one of the things that these bell callers made me think about, and I was thinking about it, reflecting what you said before we went to the phones, I mentioned Dante Wilson, a young man who got his social work degree here at Morgan State University. When I see him work with young people, and they sit in this group after school, and these are young kids, elementary, middle school kids, and they've had confrontations with teachers, they've had confrontations with other students. One of the things he does is to make them stop and think about alternatives, think about ways of dealing with life around you. I mean, that's the part, you know, that we don't, as a measure in place of, let's say, harsh discipline, suspensions, and everything else, the whole idea of helping people learn how to think through what they do. You talk about in your book the guy who was said he'd never drank before, but was drunk and killed his family.
Yes,
because you know we don't take the time to stop and think about what we do before we take an action, because we live in an impulsive world, and it takes over our children in greater ways than many.
And we do not know that we have an alternative. You said a very important word, an alternative. This is precisely what thinking gives you: alternatives. And it bypasses the danger of being hasty, of impulse. Very often we get in trouble because we follow impulse. Good thinking is the alternative to impulse. And at the end of the day, thinking well is important because it allows you to live well.
As you write, I mean, you talk about in your book, we live in this culture of just do it. We live in the culture of you only do things if it feels good to you. Or
yes.
Just Ben and Jerry's, whatever that was you wrote about Ben and Jerry's.
Yes, yes.
That's the world that we're in. So we think like that almost immediately, almost as a response.
Well, the most incredibly impressive in the wrong way, creating an impression that is very negative, phenomenon of the last 200 or 300 years is that we went from a world where it was important to be good to a world where it's important to feel good. And that has made an enormous difference in the lives of all of us. And I don't know of any revolution of the past 300 or 400 years that has had the impact of this change of attitude, of going from the importance of being good to considering our main goal, to feel good.
There's such wisdom, as you write in your book, in the ancients.
And yes, you can find plenty of it if you look for it.
Yeah, I was really taken, because people often use this word stoic, and they use it in a way that's not precise.
Yes,
and you write about the Marcus Aurelius and the Stoics and what they taught that period of time and what they teach us.
Yes, absolutely. There is always some room in my writings for Marcus Aurelius from Epictetus, the boys of antiquity, because they have a lot to say to us, and they are very sane. They were the authors of self-help books of the time. That was what the moralists did in those times of antiquity. And one of the messages of the Stoics is that it's a message of responsibility. You are responsible of your actions. And your task in society is to be a good citizen and a good neighbor. Goodness, they were not afraid of using words like goodness. We are kind of afraid of using words like goodness today because they seem to be quaint, and they have a sort of an archaeological patina on it because they are so not used very often as they did. But you're right. The reader of this book can expect to find a good amount of advice coming from antiquity
throughout the book.
Throughout the book, and from, in particular, this emperor who loved philosophy, Marcus Aurelius, and this slave, Epictetus, that became the number one Stoic thinker in his lifetime.
That's a great story. I'd like a book just on him would be interesting.
Oh, yes, absolutely. You're tempting me now.
Good. I want to. 410-319-8888. Mel, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark. Good evening to you and your guests. How are you doing?
Good evening, Mel. Welcome.
Good, good. I appreciate the information that's been disseminated by the gentleman there. And I was thinking back of the famous essayist back in the 1600s, James Allen. Remember he wrote Think and, not Think and Grow Rich, but As a Man Thinketh?
Yes.
A little small book. And then
he was influenced by the Stoic philosophy, by the way.
Exactly. And the same with Napoleon Hill.
Yes, absolutely.
Right, and the Norman Cousins you were just talking about, and Norman Cousins had even found a way that could form therapy with belly laughing.
And Dale Carnegie as well.
Yes. And Dale Carnegie also has his institutions. And, you know, you go all the way back to the granddaddy of all, that you have all these guys, you know, that really has good minds to put together. And now, I'm working on my second master's now, and I've noticed that all academia now is based on critical thinking. You know, whether it's management, whether it's humanity, they all get into a lot of critical thinking. So we are learning now to form models to help us think, like you would, you know, as opposed to just jump conclusions or just share the moment.
Right. Well, we have about 2 minutes left. I'd like to get Massimo have a chance to respond.
Well, I couldn't hear very well because there was some static on the line. But from what I understand, what the caller was saying is that it was important for him to acknowledge these thinkers. There is a level of thinkers of self-help that is in between the very lowbrow and the academician. Academicians' book that are written by the philosophers, by the moral philosophers who are working in academia today. And I think that I personally am very interested in this middle ground, middle brow of philosophical and advice for living, because I think it is what the thinkers of antiquity did, that is where they positioned themselves. And so I agree that with all of the names that the caller was presenting as being powerful presences, and I think that they, although they have not come out on the scene recently, they have been around a long time, and they still have a lot to say to us.
I think that this idea of thinking is, no pun intended, critically important, just in terms of, you know, I think when we think, when we argue, we always argue like our point of view as being the one that is correct without thinking through, without listening, hearing, and thinking. Do you know what I'm saying?
Because we are more interested in prevailing upon the other person than in bringing right. out the truth or something valid for both of us.
Massimo Forni, it's always a pleasure to see you and have you in the studio. It's been a long time. Welcome back to us. Good to have you here.
Mark, I hope to see you again
soon. We will. Dr. P.M. Forni, F-O-R-N-I. Though this book is The Thinking Life, How to Thrive in the Age of Distinction from St. Martin's Press. We'll link to it on our website, steinershow.org. And we're going to take a brief break and come back. My dear friend Anthony McCarthy will come in to co-host. We'll be talking to Kiefer Mitchell about his vote on marriage equality and why he did it in the face of some church opposition, and talk about some other issues as well during the course of the hour with Anthony. So please stay with us. We'll be right back.